Welcome to Veterinary Ophthalmology, a podcast hosted by Dr. DJ Heusler, a board-certified veterinary ophthalmologist by the American College of Veterinary Ophthalmologists, and his co-host, John Lobby. Dr. Heusler owns and operates the Animal Eye Institute. Here, we talk about medical intervention, surgical correction, and current issues in veterinary ophthalmology. Our goal is to level you up in veterinary ophthalmology.
Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 19 of the Veterinary Ophthalmology Podcast. I'm your co-host, John, here, of course, with our host, the outstanding Dr. DJ Heusler. How are you, DJ?
Great. Good to be back. We got a good one for you guys today.
I know. We're hitting back full stride into our, we're coming out of our lecture series that we did, talking about all the different great lectures that Dr. Heusler attended or provided across the world. And now we're back into our special guest series that we're doing here around veterinary ophthalmology. So DJ, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest for today's podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. This is my pleasure to have this gentleman on. This is Dr. Dennis Brooks. He is an Illinois State University Bachelor of Science graduate from 1971 to 1974. He got his Doctor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois. So another Big Ten graduate there from 76 to 80. Became board certified in 1984. Completed a PhD in glaucoma at the University of Florida in 1997. He's been president.
87.
Oh, the
13 years.
The website
was really wrong.
Could Wikipedia be wrong?
Oh, my web search was wrong. Somebody out there has it wrong. But rather than complete,
I'll tell you.
He was there. Not only did he not complete his PhD in 1997, he completed it in 87, but he was president of the ACVO in 1997.
There we go.
He's written over 180 academic scientific publications, some of which he regrets, apparently.
Four
of them. 76 book chapters. He's solidified $2.3 million in research grants, over 300 lectures worldwide, published textbooks in equine ophthalmology as well as small animal ophthalmology. He's a British Equine Veterinary Association Sir Frederick Smith Memorial Lecturer and Medal recipient in 2007. He received the Frank J. Mild State of the Art Award of the American Association of Equine Practitioners in 2010. He's the AAEP Distinguished Educator in 2016 and the Norton Teaching Award at the University of Florida in 1999 and the SCAVMA Teacher of the Year Award at the University of Florida in 1998. Welcome the illustrious Dr. Dennis Brooks.
What? Dr. Brooks, with all that, why are you here with us? What the heck is that? That's crazy.
Well, I got a letter of reprimand too. But you don't put that for something I didn't do. Anyway, that's another story, but it's sort of profane, and so we can't tell it. But
it all adds to the experience, right?
You know, something I'm really proud of is that I'm the only person, evidently, who's gotten the British Award and the American Award for helping practitioners in both countries, and and I didn't know that until somebody pointed it out. But I thought that's actually a pretty cool thing.
That's a very cool.
That is a cool thing. That's a cool thing.
DJ John, if you're sitting on an airplane,
yeah,
somebody you don't know next to you, and they're a talker, which I hate, mm-hmm. and they ask you what you do, DJ. If somebody asks you what you do, what do you say?
Oh, that's a good question, and this obviously comes up a lot.
Can we acknowledge the fact that this is the first guest that has turned the podcast backwards? It turned it backwards. I love it. I'm here for it. I'm here for it. What is it you do, DJ? Tell the annoying John that's sitting next to you.
I just work in finance.
DJ, waste management. I just lie. I mean, and I'm a terrible liar, but if somebody asks me, and I just lie. It depends on my mood. But one day, a guy did it to me, and he told me his job was he climbed those antenna towers and changed the light bulbs. And like I don't know now if he was lying or if he was telling the truth, but it was really a good lie.
There's not a chance in hell I would tell anybody on an airplane that I'm a veterinary ophthalmologist.
Well, I'm like the world's worst liar. So I was flying out of Mexico City, flying back, and the lady next to me asked me what I did, and I just I didn't have time to lie, so I just blurted out the truth.
Oh my gosh!
I'm a horse eye doctor, and she didn't give a damn.
Wow! I mean,
really?
Which was fine because I didn't want to talk to her anyway.
Yeah,
see, I should.
Yeah, exactly. I thought you were going to go down the route where she was just going to be the most interested person in the world.
But usually if you tell people you're a veterinarian on an airplane, they start talking to you about flea control and stuff like that.
They say my dog's tail got hit. What do I do with it?
I will say on airplanes though, I usually wear a hoodie and I put the hood up as soon as I sit down, and I make myself very unapproachable because I don't like to talk to people in that regard. I just don't.
Well, evidently I look like, if I'm on a Mexican airline, I go to Mexico a lot. There's another story about that. But I evidently look like somebody that's on Mexican television.
I mean, not really?
The most famous person, whoever that would be, but like some minor character. And so people will go, who's that?
That's fantastic.
And my Mexican friends don't know who it is, but they're the ones that told me you look like some person on some local Monterey television station.
That'd be pretty awesome to figure out who that is and then take that story to the next level on an airplane.
My name's Javier Vasquez. Have you heard of me?
Yeah.
I mean, so how do you think it would go if this happens? Like, so ask me the question, Dr. Brooks.
What do you do for a living?
Is that
the question you want, or you want another?
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
How do you spend your time?
I'm the mechanic on this plane. How do you think that one's going to go over?
Well, I actually sat next to a mechanic on a plane once, because I'm like a 2 million mile flyer on Delta or some ridiculous amount, which is anyway. And he was a mechanic, and they had jumped. They couldn't get the cargo door shut. So we couldn't take off. So he was not allowed to go help. He knew how to fix it, but he couldn't. So because he wasn't on duty or whatever.
The union prevented him from helping.
Union rules of thought.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh my gosh.
Anyway, I had this DJ. You're a little younger in your career than me, but I hope you have as good a career as I am having and have had, because it's like, I mean, I have friends everywhere, all over the world, and I'm really proud of that.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm sick of flying. You know, the novelty is off. I mean, I was sitting on a plane coming back from Texas, and the flight attendant walked up and said, they know about you. They know that, you know, they have a list of all the passengers. They know. And she said, Dr. Brooks, she said, do you realize you have more frequent flyer miles than any other passenger on this flight?
Holy
cow. Oh my gosh.
That made me laugh because I was having a bad day. And then she started laughing because she was having a bad day. And all the people were watching were laughing hysterically. So I had to figure out how long it takes to fly 2 million miles. And averaging 500 miles an hour, that's about 5 months of my life was sitting in an aluminum tube.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, wow.
You know, and
I'm also very fond of the friends that I've made as you accumulate more and more friendships as you get older and things. I will say the last time that I flew to Mexico, I was in a terminal and at a layover, and the thing was just packed and everybody was angry and arguing. And I took a picture and put it up on my Facebook and wrote, why do I like doing this? You know, I don't know why I enjoy this, but I do. But I think it is the friends that you make in different communities.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of that. I mean, veterinarians are generally very nice people.
Yep.
And if you get to travel and see veterinarians in different countries, you'll find veterinarians doing, no matter what economics are, I mean, they're doing their damnedest, their best to take care of people that own animals. And it's like, makes me really proud.
Yeah, me too.
DJ, I may be the luckiest person you've ever met, and I'm only this big, you know. But, you know, I mean, but I'm probably never going to get to Australia, New Zealand. I have a lot of friends there, but it's just too far. I just don't. Here's why. 2 years ago, my wife and I bought a farm here. It's 140. It's a functioning farm. DJ, I'm a farmer now.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, look at you.
I mean, it's a beef cattle farm, what you do with a farm, you
but lease that's hard. Beef is hard.
Oh.
You're up all hours in the morning, all hours in the night.
I mean, I was sitting on a tractor all day, and I'm kind of beat. And I got a decent tractor, but it's like it's not big enough.
Yeah, well, it never is.
Is it ever big? I mean, like, come on. DJ and I have boats, and the guy that sold us our boat said nobody ever buys a smaller boat the second time around. Yeah. It's same thing with a tractor. Nobody buys a smaller tractor.
Yeah, and this was a very large family farm. And over the years, the family sold off little bits. And so they sold us their favorite part was what they sold at the end. And it's a really unique place. And it needs energy. I mean, so we're putting energy into it. You can tell the land just like, DJ, I'll send you pictures tomorrow or something.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
The sunrise and sunset. I mean, it's just amazing. And my wife's a vegetarian and we got 60 cows. And eventually she's only bought one so far. And eventually she'll. Anyway, well, do you know Dr. Gillette at all?
Yeah, I do, of course. Yeah.
Well, I have lunch with him about every month, and he just told me. Well, when we go have lunch with him, we just sit there and ask him a question. He just talks kind of like this is, I guess.
Yeah.
Or worse, but he has 60 cows, and his wife, who's passed away, unfortunately, she named them all.
Oh, you can't do that in farming.
Well, he can't sell them.
That's right. They're pets now.
He's already there. Some of them are almost 20.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got a
few of them died of old age. And I mean, he takes care of them, but they're none of them going to market.
Yeah. Once you change their name from A306 to Bobby Sue, you're doomed.
Exactly. Yeah. I said, and they all have the same name, you know, because Kirk, can you tell them apart? I said, no.
They're all named Betty. Every single one of them. Hey, Betty, come here.
Yeah, Betty. Yeah, they're all.
If there's any
Bettys
out there that listen, I apologize. It's the first name that came to mind.
Well, that reminds me that sort of thing because the connection, obviously, with Dr. Gillette one of my mentors was David Wilkie, and so he would have clients come in and students would ask, "What color horse is that?" And every time he would just say, "It's a brown one." And they would get so mad at him, and he would say, "I don't care what color it is. I fix its eyes." But every horse is brown. They're all brown.
Dave Wilkie is one of my best friends.
He's awesome.
I doubt if you know why.
Probably not. No.
No. No. Yeah. I probably shouldn't tell you right now.
You don't have to. It's
hilarious. We'll do that later.
Basically, DJ, he and I don't like Van Gogh.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
No, there is a Van Gogh museum somewhere in the world, and he and I were there together, and we didn't really know each other. But after this museum, he's one of my best friends ever. You know,
the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Misery loves company.
He's one of the best. He still is. You know, he and I are very, very close friends. Seriously, very, very close. And he is my brother.
Yeah.
And he sends pictures, you know, to everybody when he's up in Canada boating and out camping and so forth. And I miss him.
Yeah, he's living the life. You know, recently I've seen him. He's either up in Canada boating or he's down somewhere warm water diving. So he's living it up.
And he still teaches. He still does some Zoom teaching and he does some vet PD stuff. And
he still does the Envision course out in Germany.
So. Yeah. I'm glad he does because I left the University of Florida in 2015 and I found out the first thing you find out when you retire is you don't know what day of the week it is because it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
That's not dementia. It's just it's a Tuesday or Sunday. You know, yeah. It doesn't matter. But one of the things is you talking to people requires practice. Mm-hmm. Just a social conversation requires. And if you're at home all day waiting for your wife or spouse to come home or whatever, and you haven't talked to anybody except your dogs or horses all day long, sometimes that's not good.
Yeah.
Over a period of time. And so it's like I learned pretty quickly that I'm never going to retire. I told the university I retired, but I really quit.
Yeah.
That's a big difference, you know, to me psychologically.
Yeah.
I should have left a few years earlier, but you mentioned I got this award from AAEP for distinguished educator or something. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I get that in, I think, 2016. I left the university in 2015. So I had to give up and have an acceptance speech or short thing. So I told the audience, there's a big crowd of four or 500 people. I'm speaking a little bit. And I said, I told them I left the university, but I told the university I retired, but I really quit. And everybody laughed. And after this thing's all over, here comes the dean of Florida. He was in the audience.
Oh, gosh.
And he's got a big smile. And he heard me. He's got to shake my hand and everything. Okay, Jim, I got you. I wasn't lying, though. I said, it's time to get out of there.
Yeah. Well, I see that you have your beginning of your education in Illinois. Did you grow up in Illinois?
Yeah, I'm from Illinois. I'm from Western Illinois. I'm from a town called Quincy, which is the most, Illinois has a kind of a bump on it. It's the most Western city in Illinois. It's two hours north of St. Louis and 2.5 hours south of Davenport and Moline and East Moline and so forth. So it's really a nice part of the world. And that's one of the problems I have with farming is because the farms up there, most of the animals are gone, they're soybeans and corns. So, but they're like manicured. It's like a golf course. There's no fences, so the farmers, there'll be the road, and then there's a space of grass, and it looks like somebody cut it like on a golf course. So that's what I think a farm is supposed to be like. So I'm trying to recreate that in this farm here in North Florida. I'm losing the battle. But
I was just going to say, there's probably a lot more. There's probably a lot more dung in your farm than what was in the soybeans soybean fields.
You get used to it sort of in some sense.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah.
But I ride bicycle. I ride bicycles now. So, and I took one of my bikes to the bike shop today to get some work done on it. And, the guy said, well, I hope there's no manure on the tires. I said, there is.
yeah, there is. That's what makes it zing.
Deal with it.
Yeah,
if you're bothered by it all. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. So
how did you get from the beginning of your career? How did you get down the ophthalmology pathway?
Well, probably. I wasn't a good vet student, first of all. So, but to paraphrase this, I grew up in a tiny, tiny little town of 2,000 people called Camp Point in Illinois. And when I went to first grade, I was a pretty smart kid, except I was just talkative. And I probably had one of those hyperactive kid things, but nobody knew that I was talking.
Yeah.
Well, I went to first grade.
So you're like John.
Dr. Brooks, no joke. I told my dad's 81, and I told him that, I'm in my mid 40s now, and so one of the things we bond over is talking about our medication. and I was like, so that's my ADD medication. And he was like, ADD? I was like, and I looked at him, I was like, yeah, I have, attention deficit disorder. He said, well, how the hell do you have attention? What do you mean? When were you diagnosed with that? And I looked at him and I said, Dad, you've known me for well over 40 some odd years. Do you really think that I don't have this? He said, well, you're probably right.
Yeah.
So I go to first grade and I don't do very well. And so my parents are in shock, but the town is so small. Even the neighbors go to the first grade teachers to complain and find out. It's I just love this stuff. Anyway, so I couldn't see the blackboard. I needed glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, those days you didn't get, I don't know, I guess now they test kids. I hope they do out.
Yeah.
Because anyway, so I think I was still talking to it. Anyway, so I got interested in eyes pretty early, but I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I went to vet school and my classmates remind me, because I've forgotten, I was kind of in a stupor for periods of time at that period of my life. They said, you took extra ophthalmology and stuff. Illinois is kind of where ophthalmology started in academia with McGrain and so right there. I mean, right there in Indiana, right near us, and Bill McGrain. And he actually liked me for some odd reason. Still not sure why. But I had this policy, though, when I would go some places, I would get the yellow pages out, which people now can't do, I guess. And if I found an interesting ad, I would call the vets. Mm-hmm. So I went I went to Massachusetts because I wanted to do an internship at Angel Memorial. I was the first alternate. I didn't get an internship. So I called a guy named Alan Bachrach, who was one of the first private practitioner ophthalmologists, but he was not board certified. But he had done a residency at Penn, and he was there, and he's very successful, and he liked me as well. So when I decided, I said, Florida, there was a little tiny little ad in the AVMA journal about, you know, come to Florida and do ophthalmology. You know, and then so I wrote Dr. Gillette, and Alan Bachrach wrote me. He was a practical joker. He's unfortunately passed, but and he wrote this wonderful letter, which I've lost. Mm-hmm. But some of the things I remember what he said about me, and I used those things about other people in writing reference letters later. They were such wonderful things. Anyway, he wrote this wonderful letter to Kirk, and he had a big rubber stamp and stamped bullshit on it and sent it to Kirk.
Oh, my God.
It took me a long time to figure out that if Kirk had a sense of humor or not.
Oh, my God.
But bullshit. Anyway, so I went, I got to go, you know, went to Florida. I went to Massachusetts and worked in a private practice after graduating for 1 year. So I never did an internship. I went to Florida. I was not in a residency. I was in an NIH traineeship, mm-hmm. and I got paid more than the residents, did not have to do general emergency duty, blah, 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 you know. And so I was a federal employee. And so when students now want to do what we do, DJ, and they ask me, I didn't do an internship. Some of them have done two or three internships. I didn't do a residency. ACBO says you can't do that now. You have to do a residency.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I'm a failure, but I was successful.
Yeah. I'd say you're quite successful.
But I did in non-traditional, you know, I really wish ACBO would back off this, whatever it's done to itself, and put some flexibility back into the system, because I think some people can get training without being 1 year of internship, 3 or 4 years of residency, and blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually, Mondays are my days that I travel around and see horses, and I do barn calls. And so I had an intern in one of my interns in the truck with me today, and we had quite a discussion about the history of training and how, you know, there was, you know, in my history is obviously not as long as your history, but I'm a fan of watching this stuff over time and you know, how we went from single doctor training programs to then requiring two or more mentors. And then now we're going to, well, you can be a single doctor if you join up with another doctor somewhere else. And there's obviously some positives and negatives to things that decisions that are made and debatable
well, sort of training programs. I mean, if you want to know, I'll tell you, but not on this podcast.
Sure, okay? No problem. Yeah,
I can tell you exactly why this has happened, and it's time to go back.
Yeah, yeah. I feel what you're saying. Yeah.
It's evolution.
Yeah,
it's evolution. You know.
And evolution doesn't always evolve correctly, and so it corrects itself. You know. Anyway, that's fine. I mean, I'm really proud of ACVO, but it's time to. It's getting dogmatic, and that's not a good thing. Time to change a little bit. Have you been on the exam committee?
I have not been on the exam committee. I was chair of the public relations committee for a few years. I was on that committee for years. I've been off of a committee for a couple years. So, but obviously aware of the changes with the exams and everything.
Yeah. The funny thing is, you know, I was in academia for 34 years. And proud, and it was, I got teaching awards, you said, and you know, and I was the best thing though to me though, DJ, was when I left the University of Florida, or was announced I was leaving. There was they said, some of my people in ophthalmology said, do you want to have a retirement party? I said, no, I don't do that. And then a couple months later, one of them came up and he said, you know, the thing you don't want to do? I said, yeah, it's June something, June 10th or June 11th. Okay. So me and Bo, we go to this thing, and it's a restaurant I've never been to, which is not surprising. And anyway, so here's one of my friends walking out, and he's going back to his car. And I said, you know, what's going on? I said, well, I took my revolver into the restaurant. I'm going to leave it. Yeah. Okay. Fine. So then I get in there, and there's three or four of my residents, and they're all dressed up, and they look really wonderful. And I thought, oh wow, that's a really nice thing. And then they opened the door. And there was like 75 people. They'd come from South America and Europe, and in Japan, and I mean all over. But GJ, John, one of the best things was this. Even the janitors came.
Oh, there you
janitors in Florida came.
Well, because that shows a lot of respect.
Yeah. I was one of the good guys, and that's what their words, because I talked to them.
Yep, it's amazing. Yeah. You know, it's
that's and boy, did I have a clean office.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a huge sign of respect is, you know, do you treat the janitor the same way you treat a PhD? You know, it's a big thing.
There's other stories I won't tell you, but some other podcast number two or something, but it was funny. They that was the best thing ever. And so I had, and one of the best things I ever did in my career, talking about careers, is it depends on how you count, but 31 or 32 residents.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. The things that I wanted to know was how I figured you were clipped between 30 and 40 is what I thought.
Yeah, something like that. And it, you know, but it's like, DJ, I found out pretty early that I knew that I wanted to work in a group of people, that I would learn more faster if I was with talented, smart people.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And I think maybe my best thing that you don't get an award for is selecting people.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. And now's the time, as you know, you're writing letters of recommendation, and this is the time of year that this happens. And you get one crack at that as a mentor, and that can make or break your days for the next 3 years.
Well, absolutely. And I've made errors, but I'm still really very close to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I chewed their rear ends out, one or two of them a few times, you could probably guess who, but it doesn't matter. They're still loyal to me and me to them. So even though we did have a day or a week or whatever, you know, it's like there was still that bond that's addictive.
Yeah, it is. I agree with you. One of my goals professionally has always been that I wanted to always remain on very good terms with anybody that I helped train. And so far, so good. You know, for me, I'm not up to 32 yet. I've got two that have passed, and I've got three in the tank right now. And, you know, I've got good relationships to the best of my, at least on my end, with them. And that's important to me. That's one of my.
And as you get more and more, you kind of grow apart a little bit, but like now I'm at this age and stage where the ones I haven't seen in a while are coming back.
And vice versa.
Cause they want to talk to me. There was never a problem. It was, you know, it's just got growing. You know, somebody's in California, you don't see them very often, or they don't go to the ACVO, or I don't go to the meeting. I mean, the reason ACVO exists is so you can see your friends.
Yeah, it is. And, you know,
and if you don't go, you don't see them for a while.
And I can tell you on their end, of course, I can't speak for someone, but I kind of will here is that.
Why not?
Because it's my experience is that it's just as rewarding for me to reconnect with my mentors. I mean, I as any two guys would have, you know, me and Dave had some rough spots over the years, but they've been just great over the last couple of years after we talked some things out and stuff like that. And now I feel a lot closer to him, and it's been a lot more rewarding for me in my life, you know?
Yeah. That kind of bond is unique, I think, that you and I have with these people. And I don't know about the term, you know, resident and mentor and all that, but it's about friends.
It is.
In my world, I don't have children, so friendship is the highest level of interaction or whatever you. And I cherish my friends, and so I said earlier when we got fouled up in the internet, but you know, I have friends all over the world.
Yeah.
And I don't really like to travel that much, but I've been traveling, and you know, I'll get a phone call, and my wife doesn't want me to leave either, and then she'll hear the story, and then the next thing I know, I'm on a plane flying to Madrid.
Yeah.
You know, or to do a corneal transplant on a horse who doesn't need a corneal transplant.
Yeah, but it's a good reason to travel to Madrid.
Well, you know, Dr. Brooks, I'll tell you just from my experience, you know, I've spent all of my professional career in philanthropy. So it's all about relationships, but so much of it is just local.
And by going down this journey with DJ to start this podcast, I never thought in my life that I would be able to say the words, I have a friend, let alone three, that live in Brazil and practice medicine, right? Like I communicate with those guys fairly regularly, and you know, I see myself at some point in the coming years, who knows when, but going down there and getting to visit another culture. I admittedly hate traveling. My idea of traveling is driving to your state from Ohio to Florida. That's my idea of traveling. And it, going down this journey has really opened my eyes to, and I work in the medical profession, and I realize that on the human medicine side, there's a good deal of camaraderie, but to the point that you were making, the level of collegiality and friendship and, you know, going to ACVO to be able to, yeah, you learn from the lectures, but where you learn is in the conversations, right?
It's out the hallway.
Yeah. It's in the hallway.
It's coffee. It's at dinner. It's
coffee, dinner, drinks, whatever it might be. It's really cool to see. And I have a 18-year-old nephew who's getting ready to make his college decisions. And in high school, he's taking veterinary classes in high school. So he's going to be a veterinarian. And so I know he may listen to this, but, and he does quite often, because he gets to hear stories from individuals like you across the world and Jack down in Brazil, just to name one person, but you know, about this great collegiality that there is around animal medicine. It's been really cool to be a part of, and I'm very lucky to be a part of it.
Me too.
Yeah.
I can't believe I get to do this, period. It's an amazing thing. It took me a while to figure this out, but just before, let me answer before you answer. Okay. Is what is your job? Okay. Truly. And here's my answer. My job is helping people who own horses with severe eye problems. That's how my job now. Okay. You don't have to answer either, but just, I mean, you know exactly what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I say that.
Yeah. I mean,
and it's not, and your, John, your nephew, or the kid in high school you're talking about, it's like, he doesn't know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
This is a people business.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunately, and my wife's very, I mean, I'm married to a veterinarian. I mean, who else do you meet? You know? So it's like,
DJ can attest to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The profession has a very high suicide rate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the profession's extremely concerned. And I don't know why. I don't know if anybody knew why, they could help a lot more people. But, and I've lost a couple of my friends to that. And we don't, it's just like, it's a people business.
Yeah, it is. And I would say, and you know this more than I do, but you know, my job is helping people by helping an animal that they deeply care about. And then my other aspect of my job is helping staff and residents have a successful career ethically and learning the proper way to do things so that they can provide the service for people that that then they care about, and those people care about their animals. So
I mean, this is part of the reason I've traveled the world and have so many frequent flyer miles, is because it's like, I want to go help people in Sweden or Brazil or Peru or South Africa, train those people so they can help the people there that own those horses or own those cats or own the, it doesn't matter. But it took me a long time to figure this out.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite location that you've been to? Either lecture or what's
Japan.
That?
Japan. That was quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I almost said it when you were talking earlier, because you were talking about Brazil, and I like Brazil too as well. Japan is just way cool.
Yeah.
Here. The thing is, we all have stereotypes about another country or whatever, part of a state in the U.S. or whatever. And I thoroughly enjoy having my stereotypes altered.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you go to Brazil, then you're going to see the Brazil's wonderful place. Mm-hmm. Or if you're going to go to Japan, it's going to be, God, there's a lot of Japanese people there. And they're very polite. And if they don't like you, you'll never know it.
That's true. Yeah. I bring a lot of these lessons back. I think when I travel, you know, I routinely tell my staff, like, you know, you're whining about stuff that doesn't matter. You know, you go to some of these countries, maybe in South America, and I say to them, you know, they have a fraction of what you have, and they're four times happier. And, you know, we could all take a page out of their book, you know.
But they're all those practitioners in the countries that the economy is not perfect. They're working hard.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
They're providing very good care. Do they have the technology? Not always, but technology is a burden sometimes.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to do ophthalmology with a pen light.
Yeah.
So I'm reverting. I'm going backwards.
To a lantern. You're going to go back to the days of a lantern.
Almost. You know, the book I use is, I can't remember the title. It's written by a guy named Nicholas, who was a French cavalry veterinarian in 1914. Mm. Have you ever read this book?
No.
Have you ever seen it?
No.
There's the French version. There's a French version with color pictures or painting drawings. There's the English translation in 1925. And then there's another translation later. DJ is pretty accurate.
That's for cool. A lot of
things. That's pretty neat. That's cool. Yeah.
There's one or two things though about, like, if a horse has an injured one eye, that you should do something and injure the other eye for sympathetic effect. That part is right. You know, and those
if its leg is broken, just break the other one. It'll be okay.
Yeah, I worry about some, but the observations, just the exam stuff. I mean, they didn't have the word glaucoma because it didn't exist, but it's still, like, you know, hypertensive. They could tell with their fingers the pressure.
Oh my gosh!
Hypertensive uveitis is what they call glaucoma in those days.
Wow.
There's certain, you know, there's certain things that I've had the opportunity to, again, work with a lot of doctors on the human side. And there's certain people that, from, like, an orthopedic standpoint, I was talking to this guy that used to play in the NFL. He said, this doc could just, like, hold your knee and tell you what's wrong with it and then fix it by touching it. Where now they say, oh, you got to get an MRI, you got to get a CT, you got to do this, you got to do that. It's like you know, the technology may change, but there's still tenants that are the same regardless of what you're caring for.
It's amazing to see. Sometimes I just think that we're really lucky to be able to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you taken on any injuries from horses in your long career?
Knock on wood, no.
Yeah. That's good.
Oh, that's good.
I rode my bicycle into a tree and broke my arm. I guess that does.
Well, were you on the way to see a horse?
No.
Well, we can't count that then. We can't count that.
Actually, that comes up a lot. People, horse owners, the horse, they'll ask me if I ride. Mm-hmm. And my initial response, I have to be really careful. My response usually is, no, I don't ride. Who'd want to ride horses?
Who would want to do this crazy thing?
I ride bicycles. No. That's dangerous enough. But I like, as a runner, I like to watch them run. I like being around them. They're amazing animals. But I don't want to ride them.
Well, one, I've got three broken toes that I can accumulate to the horses. But when people ask me, you know, if I ride or anything like that, my answer is I'm not getting on the back of an animal that is able to take out Superman.
There you go.
You know, an animal that horse paralyzed Christopher Reeves, who's Superman. And therefore I am a mere mortal compared to that guy. I ain't doing it.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I like to. What happened with me is, you know, I showed up in Florida in '81, and, you know, and there was a lot. It was really a good time in ophthalmology then. I mean, there, and I mean, all the research, but they were really, really busy. I mean, and we were seeing all these big, beautiful horses. We were right in the middle of Florida's horse industry, and there was just nobody. There was no time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't do everything.
So and is that kind of how you slid into being the horse guy?
Exactly what. Yeah. So yeah, Joan Dziedzic and I, Joan was my resident mate. And so we started the same day, the same minute. We walked in to see a small animal together, and the client didn't want to see residents. So we immediately walked out. That's how our residency started.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. But anyway, it's like I'll see the horses.
Yeah.
And what I learned really quickly again is if I'm not going to, I don't know much about them. So get somebody who does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like one of the people was my technician that I had most recently. His name was Butch. He was a horse whisperer. So, I mean, and in fact, if there was a problem with a horse anywhere in the hospital, they'd go get Butch and he would come and calm the horse down, whatever, you know, get the horse under control and whatever. And so he was a character. I worked with characters my mm-hmm. whole career. He was a Marine in Vietnam, and so he was a undercover policeman. He would make drug deals for the local police. And undercover and stuff. Okay, Butch, but can you come to work today? You know, I got to go help the cops. Yeah, okay. And I had this phenomenal crew of people in my life that they just made me a better person. And I think they made me a better ophthalmologist than I ever could be had I been working by myself. You DJ, you got to get Kirk on your podcast.
I do, and I was
he'll do it.
I'll send him an email.
I'll
name drop you since now I've got an in. I talked to him at the bar in Boston, and I was sitting with Jack Joel Kleiner and Kirk came over, and we just asked him a couple questions, and his mind just exploded. He just dumped like a file cabinet of information on me. And then later I was talking to Dave Wilkie about this, and he's like, yeah, that's Kirk, man. You start talking and he's not stopping. He's going to keep going. And
no, you don't have to, you just get him started and he'll take off and you can have a lunch and he'll talk the whole time.
Yeah.
And he's really accurate. I mean, if you
talk absolutely.
About, I mean, do you know anything about the lawsuit?
No.
In 1978. Well, Kirk was the front. Kirk becomes president. As soon as he's president, some guy walks up with a subpoena.
I've heard this. I have heard this, that aspect.
But,
yeah, now
but,
I do.
But you know, see, you don't know what the law. See, this is the thing that bothers me. There's, for some reason, ACBO isn't being good at telling the younger people the history.
The history. The history is phenomenal to me, which is one of my main driving factors.
I mean, not everybody cares, but I mean, it's actually quite funny.
I love the history of it.
And it was, it was a restraint. It went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Mm. They refused to hear it, but it went there and it was a restraint of trade because they started ACBO, but not everybody got in.
Oh, right. Okay, right.
So there were some people that didn't get in.
Yeah.
And I met a lot of those people. You know, they used to come to the meetings. They're all passed away now, but I think. But they were friendly. They were good. And they were general practitioners doing a lot of ophthalmology. And so I don't know all the reasons why, but not everybody that was doing ophthalmology became an ophthalmologist.
And you know, I wonder if other countries are going to go through this because, as you know, other countries are now establishing their own board certification process. And there are people that are becoming very upset and aggravated if they're not let in due to some specific credential that they're missing or
it's worse than that.
Yeah. It's
if you get to travel somewhere else and you'll meet those people.
Oh yeah.
They'll ask you questions and you'll go, okay, I mean, you don't know that you're supposed to put epinephrine or heparin in the irrigation solution that goes for the makeup. You didn't know that? You know that? And, maybe your results will be better if you do. Yeah. It's like if you get the chance to talk to some of these people today, then, if they come to your practice, then just talk. I mean, I had a guy from, there's a leader, Eric Dong, who's in China, in Beijing, and he came. And I talked to him, and he went home, and he knows exactly how to form the, with this. And so the Chinese are forming their own national group, whereas Beijing was the preeminent veterinary group because of Beijing.
Yeah.
Now they need to do it national because the exact thing is happening that you just said.
Yeah.
Because enough people are, the country's so big. And anyway.
Yeah, it's going to cause a lot.
They'll figure it out. or they won't. You know, the French have two groups that don't get along. That's not unusual either. So,
you mean like two different factions of like practitioners that don't?
No, two different ophthalmology groups, and so did the Japanese.
Okay,
one's a research ophthalmologist group, and then the practitioner group, and it's like they don't get along. And I think they do. They're doing better. They know they've got a silly problem, and so it's not better to work together. But I don't know.
Well, you've alluded to some of this before, and kind of one of my other questions was, what kind of you've been through a wide breadth of experience with the ACVO, and if you think going forward, what would be one of your concerns about the future of veterinary ophthalmology? Because I wonder if your concerns line up with some of my concerns. I mean, I'm younger, so I probably have a little bit of a different.
There's a revolt brewing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether you sense it or not, because it's not directed at a person, it's directed at a whole series. The test that you took, what year did you take?
I was board certified in 2014.
Okay. That it was a lot different test. I took it in 84 and passed it, and so there's a lot of difference. So ignore that big wide difference, because in 86 the test changed and became very similar to the test you took, because they knew they had to make the test legally defensible, and they wanted to standardize it. They wanted a bank of questions, you know, and blah, 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 and they really succeeded. And I was in that first group. I was there. But so anyway, in 84, I went to take the test. I got my case reports rejected the year before. So Joan Dziesek had gone in 83 when I should have been. After 2 years, you could take the test. Mm-hmm. And I got my case report, got one case report rejected. I still remember what it was about, blah, 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 blah. I'm still, and I got so upset that I thought I made my mentors not be proud of me. And I left town for a while. You know, I was really upset.
Yeah, your world's crushed.
Failing. I'm used to failing, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm sitting there. I finally get to 1984. I get to go take the test. And it's Reuben, Meredith, Coley, Herman, and Charlie Martin. They're sitting in a room. I'm ready to do slides. Now, I'd been really intoxicated the night before. Just a little bit. Oh, but I was ready to go. You know,
you're a little bent, but maybe bent just the right amount.
Okay. Anyway, so I'm sitting there and I'm ready to go, and they flash up a picture of a alligator fundus, and I go, alligator, and like this. And Reuben Meredith goes, calm down. Okay, calm down. So we're going along, and then I had a reputation because I was doing glaucoma research in dogs in those days, and so this is during the test. They just want, it's all of a sudden we're talking about dog glaucoma, and they're asking my opinion. And I'm thinking, is this part of the test?
Yeah,
or just having a conversation? It was just a conversation. It's like, I don't know, you know. And then at some other point, Mary Bell Glaze was there. I don't know if you know Mary Bell. She's
very excellent.
And she said to me, "How are you doing?" And I thought she meant how was that about the test. I thought, well, I think I'm doing all right. And she goes, "Oh, really?
Oh no!
that's not the answer I was looking for."
I got the highest grade on the test the year I took it. And a test changes every year, so everybody, you know, you can't compare your test. So I'm really proud of that. I had to wait a whole year, and then I did really good, made my mentors proud. I hope. And then I went on the exam after another year, and then I didn't realize that they would play games with you. So when you had to take apart a Shiot stenometer because people were still using them.
Right.
I asked you to take it apart and clean it, and put it back together.
Yeah, I've heard that story before.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah.
And Nils Håkansson from Sweden, who's just retired, Nils is quite a character as well, very strict guy. We asked him to reproduce the electrical diagram for an SL5 slit lamp, which was a slit lamp we were using. Yeah. I mean, we wanted to see all the light bulbs and everything.
Holy cow.
It was a joke, you know. And he did it.
Oh, and, wow. That's even more
and
impressive.
Me and Christy Riggs and I are sitting there. We're like about fell out of our fucking chairs because like he could do it. You know, we had no idea.
Yeah, I couldn't do
so
that.
So you got away from that kind of stuff. But and so it became legally defensible.
Yeah.
But people would get so stressed that they would run out of the room and start to leave the building. And the exam committee would have to go after them and chase them and catch them and bring them back.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
but it's that part's not so bad. But it's the stories. I'm sure you must have stories. That you
took it. You know, yeah, sure. They're that you know, and I love hearing everybody else's.
Anyway,
stories.
But as far as the problem is the horses.
Yeah,
ACBO is abdicating its responsibility to the horses because a lot of the small animal people don't see Kate horses, so they don't want to train their residents. And if they do that, then either the college has to split, or it has to be addressed somehow. And I don't know how. Because right now we have people doing ophthalmology of horses that don't have the training.
Sure.
They're doing their best.
Yeah.
They're reading the books, they're attending the lectures, and DJ, they don't get it.
Yeah, yeah.
They're trying hard. They're trying hard.
I don't understand why anybody would want to willingly go see a horse if they're not adequately trained on it, because it'll put you way outside your comfort zone, you know?
Anyway, ACBO... We're writing a letter. We're putting a proposal together. Hopefully, it'll get there soon, and we'll see how much. If we, I don't want to cause any acrimony or anything, but in the college has got it. If what's wrong with having a small animal veterinary ophthalmology group and a horse group? You know, I mean,
they did it on the surgery side.
Yeah, well, they do in internal medicine. Yeah. They do it in radiology. They do it in critical care. Yeah. And I don't know. We'll see. But it is that to me is the biggest issue right now. Other people would probably say there's other issues, but I don't know what they are.
Well, so. You know what some of them are because you've alluded to them in an email recently. But there's quite a few issues going on. Not that we need to get into that because I don't need anybody throwing tomatoes at me anytime soon.
Well, if you wrote something on the internet thing, I dropped off that years ago.
No. My rule of thumb is don't be on the listserv.
I was the first person to drop off. I forget why now. It was so many years ago, but I probably don't want to know.
Because you don't need 4,000 messages in your inbox every day.
Probably about SARS. I don't need
the entire world knowing my opinions about something.
Hey, I have a question for you, Dr. Brooks. You mentioned at the beginning of the thing, I'm always curious about this because when somebody is as well written as you and as well published as you, so many people look up to what your opinion is and use it as a guiding principle for some of their care. But you said that, on the way in, you said when DJ was reading all your accolades and all your publications, you said there's four things I regret. Four of those publications. What's the one that you think out of those four that you think, gosh, I should have. Yeah, that's not right.
No, partly what is which one? All four of them have problems. I had this corneal condition in horses that I saw and I couldn't get them better. And we got histology on them and it didn't really help anything. And I bullied the reviewer by just being persistent.
Yeah.
I know who the reviewer was, I'm pretty sure anyway. But it doesn't matter now.
You just kept pounding him like.
Yeah.
This is.
And he finally said they're stromal abscesses. And I said, no, they're not stromal abscesses. He was right.
Yeah.
they were a variant of stromal abscesses. They weren't probably caused by fungi. Because the term, I think the vast majority, if not 100% of the classic stromal abscesses, or especially the deep ones, are fungal. And in some of them probably aren't. And so it's not 100%, but whatever. And that's what these cases were, I think. But the problem is this damn paper keeps showing up on the ACBO exam, and I can't get it off. I've even written that. Actually, DJ, ask somebody who thinks they've taken it if there's a question on that paper.
Ask who?
Ask any of your residents that have taken the test.
Which paper? Do you know what year it's out of?
Oh, it's a long time ago. It's past 7 years, but it keeps showing up. You know, evidently,
is it referenced in paper? Is it referenced in Gillette's Vet Op?
I can't remember if it's in Veterinary.
If it's on the test, it's got to be referenced in the textbook if it's past 7 years.
It's referenced in the textbook.
Oh, that's why it keeps landing on there then.
Yeah, I don't know anyway. But it, and then the other ones are the atropine issues, where somebody's quoted me as saying atropine topically can cause colic.
Oh, God, that's gone around forever. Holy cow.
Boy, that one has been, I've been severely criticized for that one, and deservedly and not deservedly. I mean, but my closest friends, actually, so it's not personal.
So saying that you did write that it causes colic, and
it was this, yeah, and I forget the word, it was associated with colic,
and then it doesn't, yeah, or not.
Nobody can prove, nobody, it's idiosyncratic.
Oh, that's so funny, because I mean, once a month, twice a month, I got to deal with that with a client, you know, questioning, you know, I don't want to use atropine once a day. I'm like, it's not going to do shit, you know, like it's not going to do that. But
no, and you're right. But the problem is, and it's my, and it's even worse than that. Well, you get out and lecture too, but what I've learned when I go out and lecture is be careful what you say.
Oh, you have to be real careful what you say. Stuff.
I mean, I did
even
I,
worse I, you with know, what you put out there, you know. And
I got an email from a horse vet in Hungary fairly recently, and
yeah,
and he, nice guy, and told me how he was treating the horse, and he didn't have atropine on, you know, all this 4, 5, 8 different things he was using. I wrote him back, so with atropine, oh, atropine is contraindicated. I thought that. Dead. You know, that's not what I said.
Oh man!
Pardon me. So it's like, pardon me. There, okay, I still can edit out that part. But it's like, or you know, one of the things, rose bengal. If they're rose bengal positive, that means they have fungus. That's not what I said.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not what I said. But that's a minor one. Anyway, It's interesting to see what people hear.
I did a lecture in West Virginia, I don't know, 10 years ago, and I put like a way to treat glaucoma in-house on a dog that didn't involve mannitol, but it was unpublished data, you know, it was just clinical experience and things. It works, and I'm not going to put it out here because I've fought this, and I had owners messaging me from far corners of the United States saying, like, why didn't my vet recommend this? And I didn't know where these emails were coming from. Like, wait, how do they know that this is something that I said, you know? And so I did some digging and found out some back door on the internet, this conference had my notes published or something. And I, you know, 5 years later, I wrote to them and I said, you got to get that off of there. I can't be taking emails about this 4 times a year, you know? And, but yeah, it is wild, you know, what'll get out there and run like wildfire. And that's not even published data, like, you know, what you've had and things. So.
It's funny what people, it's, you know, the last one of these, you know, is the grid keratotomies, which I never mention anymore, because every time I mention grid keratotomy, somebody goes out and grids a desmodocele.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and I find out about it. I'm like, oh, come on. That's not what I said.
I know. You know? It's unbelievable.
So now I don't say it at all.
Yeah.
You know, and I rarely do it anyway, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
I'm just like, they don't get it.
No, I
no, they're trying hard. Have you had a bad experience in a lecture? I've had two. Where I had it in Italy, I once had a guy accuse me of lying during the lecture.
lying during the lecture. Did he just stand up? Did he just stand up in the middle of it and yell?
Yes.
Liar!
Yeah. Yeah, it's lying. Yeah, well, I didn't, but he said it in Italian, and I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. But my Italian hosts, they were horrified, and he had missed the pictures. We were so actual slides in those days.
Yeah,
had a timestamp on them. He'd misinterpreted the timestamp, so he came down. I showed him, and he goes, "Oh," he felt bad. And then I was in Omaha talking about small animal stuff, and some guy just went berserk during the lecture and stood up and I don't know what the hell. And then he took off. I was going to go chase that son of a bitch because I wanted to know what he was so pissed about. I mean, what are you doing?
I've had,
and then people stopped me and they, oh, he does this all the time. What is stand up in the middle of the lecture and start going about something about genomycin and ulcers or something? And it's like, I was going to go get him because I, like, you know, what are you so upset about?
I've had two that come to mind. One is when I was in Russia in 2019, somebody asked me about a specific product
which I won't name. And I said I wasn't the biggest believer in it, and that, you know, I questioned what and I questioned whether it, you know, the data is there. And I had this gentleman come up to me afterwards, and he said, "I don't appreciate you talking about that. I sell a lot of that. I make a lot of money, and there's, you know, 400 people in this lecture hall." And I said, "You can continue to sell whatever you want." And I said, "I just, the gentleman who came up to me at the time to talk about this was Alex Konstantinovsky, who has turned out to be a wonderful friend of mine now. I love Alex to death." And so we ended up going out and having dinner that night over this interaction, but it that was kind of funny. And then the other interaction I had was one of the very first times I was asked to lecture was to a local VMA here in Cincinnati. And so they probably paid me $8 to do it or something like that. And I show up and I'm in this bar, and it's upstairs of the bar, but there's an upstairs bar up there. And they're reconstructing, you know, remodeling the bar and everything. So there's construction going on. And I see that there's a couple practitioners there that are sitting at the bar and they're doing shots. And I thought, oh, I don't know how this is going to go. So the waiter comes over to me and he says, "Would you like something to drink?" And I said, "I'll take a water or Coke, whatever you got." And he goes, "No, like, do you need an alcoholic drink?" And I said, "No, not before I lecture." And he goes, "Buddy, you're going to need it." And I thought, oh boy, this guy knows something I don't know. And, you know, I was green as can be. I was like, you know, outside my residency by like maybe 8 months, you know? And so I think there was a whopping 6 to 7 practitioners that attended this thing. And the one that I saw doing shots put his head down on the table within 12 minutes of me lecturing and passed out and took a nap. And I thought, boy, if that isn't the best lecture experience that I'll ever have, is this guy basically going, "You're not worth anything. I'm here to get my hour of CE, and I'm just gonna call it quits for the night." Luckily, those are the only two major ones I've had. But I always tell people about the guy passing out in the bar.
I was lecturing to Japanese veterinary students, obviously in Japan. And here's my stereotype. I thought that they would be respectful, you know. So I start this lecture, and the whole first row of the kids are all asleep. You know, it's laying down during the lecture, front row. And I get real pissed for some reason. I don't know why, but I did. I told the interpreter. And she told them, and at the break, they were awake, man. They didn't mean it. They just went to sleep on their own instructors. And then they when I was upset, they were like wide awake and paying attention and taking notes. And I thought, whatever. But it's like, there's a stereotype.
Yeah. One of the more interesting ones that I had is I was just down in Mexico at CVDL, and there was a lecture cancellation at the last minute. And so they asked me if I could bring somebody with me. So I brought one of my senior residents with me, and she does a good job. She does a great job lecturing. And so we get down there, and the interpreter comes up and says, "Are you guys okay? We're going to interpret." And I said, "Yeah, I've been through this before. I've lectured internationally." And I said, "You know, we'll go slow and, you know, make sure everything's okay." And she goes, no, don't do anything special. Just talk like you normally would, and we'll get through this together." I said, "Okay." So the next day we both lecture, me and Erica, and the interpreter comes up and she looks at Erica and she says, "Hey, great job. You did a wonderful job. Everything is great. Nice cadence, everything." She looks right at me and she goes, you have got a problem with. You are moving way too fast." And my resident looks at me like, "You have any lectures you've given before?" And this lady says she's got a problem with you. And she's like, "Look, I don't know what's going on. You need to slow down. You need to stop it." And my resident is just like reveling in the fact that she got 5-star treatment when I'm the one moving too fast. So that was a good win for her. So
I don't know how those people do that, though.
I don't either. They use a different gear their brain I don't have.
Yeah, their brain works different than other people. So it's like,
Well, hey, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. So let's do this fast five real quick that John's got. I greatly appreciate this and your time. It's been wonderful. So here comes John with his fast five.
John. I mean, this has been so much fun for me just to sit back and just see you two just go at it. This is
we're getting to know each other.
Oh my gosh, so much fun. So much fun.
Yeah, give it a couple of years.
A couple shots.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I joked with DJ. I said, in one of these years, I'm going to make it happen. I said to him, you're just going to have to let me attend ACVO. And you're going to let me just sit at these tables and hear all these conversations every once in a while. I also said to him, maybe we could make this thing like Radio Row at the Super Bowl. Like I could just stand outside with a big old microphone and now, and he, you, for those listening, you can't see this, but DJ's just adamantly shaking his head.
The problem is,
No,
kid leashes where you put a harness around him and you chain him to your waist so he can't get away from you.
Yeah.
That's it.
You live in Florida. Anyway, you know the Disney thing.
Let's go.
You know the five. Disney thing. All right. So, Dr. Brooks, this Fast Five is designed to help our listeners get to know you a little differently than your profession, which we've had a great conversation. I don't know how they can know you any better at this point, but it's just kind of a way for us to throw things to you somewhat rapid fire to get to know a little more Dennis Brooks and not Dr. Brooks. So how about this? Illustrious career in veterinary ophthalmology. But if you could go back and do something different, what profession would you want to do other than the one you're currently doing?
It's not going to be fast, is it?
No.
Farming.
And look, you're doing it.
Yep.
You are doing it. You mentioned earlier some performance you went to. What is your either favorite band or favorite performance you've ever been to?
Rolling Stones.
No way.
Nice one.
When?
That's a bucket list.
Let's get a year.
Let's see. They were in Orlando in 84, I think.
Ooh, what are they?
With Van Halen opening.
Oh, golly. Shit.
Woo.
Van Halen was the opening band.
Yeah, they were the opening act. Yeah, with David Lee Roth, the original band. Yeah, it was 82, I think.
Oh.
But the new song is really good. If you haven't heard the new Rolling Stones song, listen to it. It's excellent.
Oh, so that brings up another aside Fast Five. David Lee Roth or Sammy Hagar?
I like them. But I saw the original Montrose with Sammy Hagar singing. So you know, the advantage of being old like me now is I saw some great bands.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
David Lee Roth. Yeah, David Lee Roth.
Oh, see, I'm a Van Hagar guy.
Yeah, I'm a Hagar
fan. I'm a Hagar guy.
I enjoy it.
It's great stuff. Family, my first concert, Dr. Brooks, the Eagles.
Ooh.
Yeah,
it was the 1910 Fruit Gum Company and the Rugbies and the Box Tops.
Mine was Jimmy Buffett.
Jimmy Buffett.
That's so Cincinnati.
It was my first date too. It was my first date. I'd never kissed a girl, and she was out of the car before I could get it stopped, so I didn't get a kiss then.
Should have taken her to the Rolling Stones. You would have had more luck.
That's great.
So, favorite hobby of yours outside of your profession?
Oh, bicycling.
I heard you say cycling earlier. That's
outside of that.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a good.
It's not. There's so many, I guess. Hot rods.
Right up your alley.
Discussion about that some other time.
Yeah, you'll have to.
We could come down here. We'll do burnouts in my 67 Camaro.
Oh, casually drops the 67 Camaro.
I mean, that's a humble brag.
Convertible.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Nice, yeah, you're definitely going to have a side combo with DJ, Mr. Mustang over here. So what's your go-to movie? You can, if you're flipping through the channels and the movie comes on, whatever point in that movie is, you're going to sit there and watch the rest of the whole movie.
Top Gun Maverick.
Damn. You've had a lot of these Top Guns.
That's a recent one.
Old movie. Anyway, Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood. Yeah.
We've probably had four or five guests go one of the Top Guns with that being one of my favorites as well.
Yeah. DJ's son, one of DJ's sons is an aspiring. Now what? Trey's what?
He's 11 years 11. Old. He wants to be a fighter pilot.
He wants to be a fighter pilot. So he's seen Maverick probably about 12 times.
Oh, that's yeah. The funny part is I was thinking about him when you were talking about your eye issues at a young age is that, asking about, you know, do they get this done? So my oldest son wants to be a fighter pilot. And so since he was about 6 years old, I've had his eyes examined because they've got to be 20/20. And so far, he's still toeing the line.
Is he tall enough? Is he going to be tall enough? They have a height.
That I don't know. He's pretty short.
Mark, do you know Mark Rainbow in the college?
I know his name. I don't know him personally.
Yeah, he flew F-15s or
no kidding.
Yeah, and he was a half an inch short. I forget what the height, but he was. They were real strict. The day 24 hours before, he hung upside down.
Oh my gosh!
I mean, seriously. Yeah. And then he got in a truck. Pickup truck and laid down so he wasn't up, and he got in there and they got did the height thing and he was an inch over.
Oh my gosh,
short.
That's crazy. Trey's got big feet. I think
Trey's got big feet, but he's a late. I mean, I grew all the way into college, so I don't know how that'll fare for him. But just yesterday we were having a debate over what was a better fighter jet, an F-35 or an F-22, and he'll die on the hill that it's an F-22. I mean, he knows all these specs of everything.
Reading about that today. Yeah, who the hell knows?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, he does. I don't know.
Probably, he does. You know, yeah, Trey knows.
It's probably a P-51 in World War II.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Last question here on the Fast Five is a little more. The first ones are a little more light. This one's a little more, not heavy, but just more thinking introspectively. You know, we have a lot of our listeners that are undergrads, right? Or they're going into veterinary school, and they're the ones that interact with us via social media all the time. And they're top notch. They're fantastic. And they're so passionate about this work. So as you sit in your seat today, if you were to give yourself when you were their age a word of advice, what would that word of advice be?
Make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And learn from them.
Yep.
Don't be afraid of them. You won't learn anything by being right all the time. You have to foul up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to write articles about atrophy and stuff.
It's really in a clinical job like being a veterinarian. You don't like mistakes or when things don't get best, don't get better. You want everything to get better, but you learn more when things don't.
Yeah. You
do. You're wired to be a fixer, right?
Doing a research project and getting negative data where you don't understand where it doesn't fit your hypothesis. That's where you really learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your hypothesis was wrong. So now you're going to learn from it. So yeah, just make mistakes. Don't get arrested.
Make mistakes, but not arrestable mistakes. Got it.
Here, John. For me, the police were at the door. The police were at the door more than once, but they didn't walk through. Okay.
It wasn't me.
That wasn't me, officer.
It wasn't me.
Anytime you see a cop at the restaurant, buy him their meal.
Yeah, that's a good.
Just in case later, they're the ones that pull you over.
That's awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Brooks. This has been very entertaining. Thanks for your time tonight. I know it's very important and greatly appreciate it, my friend.
Take care. Bye, John.
Take care.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast with Dr. DJ Hoistler and John Lobby. Tune in next time for more educational content and current events in veterinary ophthalmology.